The Battle for Liberty, Episode 14.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. I'm so glad you've decided to listen today. Thanks so much for tuning in. Before we get started, I want to remind you that you should be subscribed to the show. If you want to do that, head on over to battleforliberty.com. You can click on any of the links to subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. So we have many different ways you can subscribe to the show. If you could do me an additional favor and share this show with a friend who you think is ready to hear the message, I'd sure appreciate it. You should also be following me on Twitter. I mean, if you're not following me on Twitter, you're missing all of the random musings that come out of my brain, and there's no fun in missing that. But if Twitter's not your thing, you'd rather send me an email. That's mike@battleforliberty.com. And the show notes page, as always, is going to be battleforliberty.com/14. That's that one convenient location for all of the content that we're going to discuss on this episode. For those of you that are new listeners, and I'm happy to report that I do have new listeners, my statistics are showing pretty well that I'm growing my listener base and the number of downloads from month to month, so that's fantastic. But just as a review for anyone who might be new to the show, the purpose of this show is to catalog and document the journey of the libertarian novice. I myself have been a libertarian novice for several years. I'm on my journey from statist to voluntarist or anarchist or libertarian or whatever you want to call it. And if you're confused about those terms, please go back and listen to the last couple of episodes. You'll get a much better understanding for what we talk about with those different terms. But all in all, what I'm trying to do with this show is shepherd people as they make their journey from a statist who thinks that the state and governments can solve all of their problems to a voluntarist who understands that only through non-aggression and a strict respect for property rights can we truly realize liberty in its purest form. So that's what the show's all about. If you're interested, I would encourage you go back and start listening to some of the older episodes. It will really help you understand what we're doing here. So we're going to jump right into today's topic. Today we are going to be talking about property rights. Yes, I've spent a lot of episodes talking about the non-aggression principle and voluntarism and some of the philosophical areas behind non-aggression and the state's monopoly on the just use of force and violence, and that's all well and good, and that is a huge part of libertarianism as a political philosophy, but I feel I haven't done justice to the notion of property rights. And so I'd like to, for this episode, go over how a libertarian addresses property rights, what we think of property rights, and where our philosophy of property rights comes from. And so for the bulk of this episode, I'm going to be relying on Mr. Libertarian himself, Murray Rothbard. It's from one of Murray Rothbard's books that I came to a much fuller understanding of libertarian property rights theories. And that book that I'm going to link to at the show notes page is his wonderful piece called For a New Liberty, a Libertarian Manifesto. It's one of my absolute favorites. I've read it several times. I'm actually going through and reading it again. That's just the kind of reader that I am. I don't know about you, but it takes me, three or four times to read a book of this magnitude before I fully understand and appreciate it. And I think the importance of this book tells me that it might be 10 times before I'm fully understanding everything that's in it. Now, that's not to say that it's a difficult book. We're not talking about Ludwig von Mises' books here. We're talking about Rothbard. And certainly Rothbard was capable of writing for an academic audience, and he did so. And some of those pieces are difficult to understand. But this piece, For a New Liberty, is not written for that audience. It's written for the layperson, much as myself. And so please do not be afraid of it. It's available for free at the Mises Institute. That's Mises.org. I'll go ahead and link to that as well. You can get this book for free in a number of electronic formats, and you can order it on Amazon for a very, very small price. So it's worth every penny, and if you don't spend anything for it, it's worth the couple of seconds of your time it's going to take you to download it and transfer it over to whatever e-reader you happen to choose. So we're going to be relying fairly heavily on Rothbard's book as we go through this discussion. So we're going to just get right into it. And so we need to first review the three basic types of libertarians. Now, these types were identified by Rothbard in his book. And to me, it's pretty clear that these types all still exist in some form or fashion. So it's important before we talk about property rights to understand these types of libertarians, because each type approaches the idea of property rights in a slightly different way. And more importantly than that, I believe, as Rothbard did, that really only one type of libertarian can effectively defend property rights in a manner that's consistent with the other core tenet of libertarianism, which is, of course, non-aggression. So I'll touch on that again later once we get there. So again, the three types of libertarians. The first one we're going to cover is called the emotivist. And Rothbard identified the emotivist as libertarians who believe in non-aggression and property rights, but based completely on their own subjective emotions. So if you wanted to put it another way, you could say that, you know, they feel in their heart that this is the right way to live or build a society, but they don't really appeal to anything other than the fact that it just feels right. And of course, there's a huge problem with this, and that problem is that they're not going to be able to convince anybody. So it's good for them, that's all well and good, but it won't do them or anyone else any good. So there's no logic or rationale for it. The worst part, of course, is that it won't serve them well as they try to apply their way of thinking to a larger body of real-world examples. So that's the first type. We're not going to spend really any more time on the emotivists. The next type is the utilitarian. And the utilitarian believes that the consequences of liberty will lead to more positive things like peace and prosperity and goodwill, etc. And there's certainly, I mean, we don't find anything wrong with assessing what the outcomes of libertarian policies or political positions would be, but you can't focus completely on the outcome. That sends you down a really tricky and slippery slope of the ends justifying the means. You begin justifying, or I shouldn't say you do begin, but it is possible to begin justifying immoral and undesirable behaviors if they lead you to what you think is the greater good. We want to avoid the ends justify the means way of thinking. And in order to more clearly see what the danger is of the utilitarian libertarian thinker, Rothbard gave a pretty good example of how you could easily see this viewpoint as flawed. And so I'm going to take this right from the book. He says, "Suppose a society which fervently considers all redheads to be agents of the devil and therefore to be executed whenever they're found. Let us further assume that only a small number of redheads exist in any generation. So few as to be statistically insignificant. The utilitarian libertarian might well reason, while the murder of isolated redheads is deplorable, the executions are small in number, and the vast majority of the public, as they are non-redheads, achieves enormous psychic satisfaction from the public execution of redheads. The social cost is negligible. The social psychic benefit to the rest of society is great. Therefore, it is right and proper for society to execute the redheads. The natural rights libertarian, who is overwhelmingly concerned for the justice of the act, will react in horror and staunchly and unequivocally oppose the execution as totally unjustified murder and aggression upon non-aggressive persons." The consequence of stopping the murders, which is depriving the bulk of society of their great psychic pleasure, would not influence such a libertarian, the absolutist libertarian, in the slightest. Dedicated to justice and to logical consistency, the natural rights libertarian cheerfully admits to being doctrinaire, to being, in short, an unabashed follower of his own doctrines. So what we're saying here is that it's not good enough that the ends are merely better for a great number of people, right? What's really important is the right of each and every individual to be free from aggression, right? Notice, too, that part of what offends the absolutist libertarian, as Rothbard calls them, is that there's a preference given to how the majority of society benefits. You see, in that example, the utilitarian is happy that the most amount of people are being benefited, while the extreme harm is limited to, you know, a negligible portion of the masses. But the absolutist libertarian, or the natural rights libertarian, as we will learn, is particularly concerned with the fact that the redheads are a peaceful people, and therefore no violence against them can be justified. And so that's a perfect segue into the third type of libertarian, and that, of course, is the natural rights libertarian. So we're going to turn our attention there now. Now, this one is a little bit longer and a little bit more complicated. First and foremost, we need to remember that the majority of libertarians throughout history have adopted the natural rights basis for the libertarian creed. So we have to first understand where does natural rights come from? Well, natural rights is a philosophy that's embedded within a much larger context of what we call natural law. And natural law theory begins with the notion that we live in a world of vast numbers of entities, whether they're human or animal or completely inanimate, right? And it further states that every entity in nature has its own specific nature, its own set of characteristics that make it different from all of the other entities. So the example that Rothbard gives, or at least one of them, is that copper is much different than silver or gold. It has different characteristics. Trees are different from shrubs or from grass. Cats are different from dogs, etc. We could go on and on. But we take it ultimately to man. And man as a species is also unique and also has his own nature. But there is a difference. The lower creatures act in nature based on their biology and based on their instinct. They're not necessarily rational beings. They don't use logic or reason in order to make decisions. They use their instinct. And this is where man is completely different. Man uses intellect, knowledge, learning, logic, reason, etc. He uses all of those things in order to employ the proper means to reach a certain end. Man decides what the proper means are and is working towards the ends that he has decided he wants to work towards. And although we'll talk about in a little bit the fact that man is a pack animal for sure, we thrive when we are part of something much bigger than ourselves, whether it's a family or a church or community or local village, whatever. It's also true that man can only employ these unique characteristics of intellect and logic and reasoning as a single unitary entity. We are only capable of thinking for ourselves. We can't force other people to think certain ways. We can try to persuade them, but we can't think for other people. So it would logically follow from all of this that if man is going to survive, he must be free to learn and develop his faculties and skills, and then act upon that acquired knowledge in a way that he sees fit. He has to be free to make his own choices about what he does with himself and with his knowledge. Therefore, the violent interference with that process, the violent alteration of a man's learning and choices, is found to be categorically anti-human, and it violates natural law. So, do you see how we arrived at that conclusion? It was a series of observations that led to another logical step. It's all very basic, and yet it's something that most people probably have never thought about. It all boils down to, basically, because of man's unique nature as a reasoning and logical creature, that he has to be free to make his own choices in order to survive. This is part of natural law. This is how we were created. It's very interesting to me. Now, almost immediately, when we talk about natural law and man as being a single solitary person, many critics of libertarians will immediately rise up and accuse us of attempting to live in some sort of solitary antisocial bubble. And therefore, we become selfish to the point of harming greater society, right? If we only think of ourselves, that's obviously selfish and inhuman. Well, there's really nothing to that argument. It's just a thinly veiled straw man argument. As I said before, I acknowledge that man is a pack animal. We understand that. We thrive when we're part of something bigger than ourselves, right? No libertarian has ever tried to argue that human beings should try to live in a vacuum. It's actually quite the opposite. Most libertarians, I should say all libertarians, encourage and welcome the voluntary cooperation and exchange between peaceful people. We understand that it's really only through peaceful trade and specialization that our society can flourish in the way that we've seen it flourish. So we really should not tolerate when we're accused of wanting to do everything for ourselves. It's often this comical, cartoonish picture that's brought about of, the outcast living on, a 50-acre piece of land, and he wants nothing to do with anyone else, and he'll do everything for himself, thank you very much, and don't bother him. That's a flat-out mischaracterization of how libertarians feel about human interaction. We don't reject human interaction. What we reject is the violent interference with those vital interactions. Such interference serves only to force individuals to think and act in ways that are contrary to the methods that they believe will benefit them the most. And that's natural rights theory of property rights. So we've covered the basic types of libertarians and the rudimentary concepts of natural rights, and that's all well and good, and it's very academic, and it's the basis of what we're about to talk about. But I told you that we were going to be talking about property rights, and so we have to ask at this point, okay, after, 16 minutes, how does all of this relate to property rights? Well, it's actually very simple. To answer that question, we were going to start with a notion of what we call self-ownership. When it comes to the idea of property rights, natural rights libertarians believe first and foremost that you own yourself. This is where we get into the actual discussion of property rights. But how did we arrive at that conclusion? Well, first, let's start with another fundamental question that most people have never contemplated. And that question is, who owns me? Who owns you, right? This is where we're really going to get into the meat of property rights. So the very first thing we're going to talk about is you as a piece of property. Who owns you? Well, there are really only three basic options to answer this question. Number one, someone else owns you. Number two, each person on the planet owns some equal share of you. And third, you own yourself. That's it. Those are the only options that exist. Either someone else owns you, everybody owns you, or you own yourself. So to figure out which one is true, I'm going to go through this kind of like I did on the SATs, right? Process of elimination. Let's start first with the idea that someone else owns you. So we have to imagine a scenario in which someone else owns your physical person. And what that means is necessarily that there is a certain class of people who possesses a right to own a second class of people, okay? Let's call the property owners the proprietorians, and we'll call the people who were owned, we'll call them the Heldonians, okay? And imagine that you're a Heldonian, okay? This scenario asks us to believe that the proprietorians possess all of the rights of being human, and that the Heldonians are actually something less than human. They are subhuman and they lack the rights of human beings. But I know for a fact that you're a Heldonian. You are indeed a human being. I can see it. I know that you were a human being. So already this scenario has fallen apart under the easiest examination, right? It can't be correct. If humans possess certain rights and the Haldonians are humans, then the Haldonians possess human rights, right? It doesn't follow that one class of people has, you know, some extra human right to own other human beings, right? It's a logical fallacy. It's one of those things that's going to keep you going in circles all night. So that can't be right. So we're forced to move on to the second scenario, which is the notion that each person on the planet owns an equal share of every other person. Okay? So now we're being forced to imagine a scenario in which each person on the planet is entitled to an equal share of everybody else. So if there are 6 billion people in the world, then that means each person would own 1/6 billionth of every other person. So as you try to wrap your head around that, I'm hoping that you're struggling to understand how it's possible that each person, including yourself, can own a portion of every other human being, but not own any more than 1/6 billionth of himself or herself. And right away, that's the first reason that this can't be correct. It's absolutely preposterous, okay? But there's a couple other reasons that it's preposterous. Next, let's assume then that no one is capable of making any decision whatsoever without first consulting with the other 6 billion people. That's an absurdity. Nothing would ever get done. It's impossible to get the consent of 6 billion people. After all, if every single person owns an equal share of everybody else, then what if one person wanted to get a haircut? Well, they'd have to get the approval of 6 billion people in order to get that haircut, right? What if someone wanted a tattoo? What if someone wanted to dye their hair? It just goes on and on. Nothing would ever get done. And so the nail in the coffin, however, for this scenario is what would happen in reality, right? If we tried to attempt that system, in reality, what would happen is that inevitably a select few people with the means of controlling other people, they would claim authority to supervise the decisions of the 6 billion people, and the society would quickly devolve into a sort of authoritarian oligarchy with one class of rulers claiming ownership over the decisions of the subservient class. Well, this is nothing more than the first scenario, right? And we've already dispensed with that. It's immediately devolved into one group owns another group or owns the decisions of another group. And of course, we just proved that can't work. So we have to conclude, after thinking about all of this, that the first two scenarios are impossible and contrary to natural law, then it must be true that each person owns himself or herself. So we find that the natural state of things is that each human being possesses a right of self-ownership. And that is truly the nexus of libertarian philosophy as it relates to property rights. That first and foremost, you own yourself. And so now that we have a beginning of an understanding of self-ownership, I think we should move on to a slightly more complex topic. And that deals with the ownership of non-human property. So how do we assess the issue of identifying the proper owners of all of the things that exist in this world? A common answer in the libertarian world, and it's typically the utilitarians, and you'll understand why here in a second, they would argue that what we should do is simply have the current governing body issue property titles to the current owners, and then that would just be our jumping off point for who holds legitimate ownership. First and foremost, it should be obvious that something in this plan stinks a little bit. I mean, don't you think it's a little strange to think that we as libertarians, and even some conservatives, who are unfailingly suspicious of every aspect of government, we then turn around and implicitly trust this same dubious organization to determine the rightful owners of all pieces of property? That just doesn't follow. I mean, if we suspect them in everything that they do, we can't then turn around and say, oh, well, we'll just trust them to assign property ownership. That just doesn't make sense. But for the moment, if we ignore even this glaring inconsistency, there's still a pretty large problem with this idea. And Rothbard illustrates this problem again with another imaginary scenario. So I'm going to use it. Let's pretend that we've reached a point where the government is ready to accept the libertarian position and just totally abdicate its power. They've given up and they're just going to give in, right? But just before doing so, the state of New York declares that the entire territory of New York is the rightful property of the Rockefeller family. And Massachusetts does the same thing for the Kennedys, and Texas does the same thing for the Bushes, and so on and so on. Now, according to what I've laid out previously, this is absolutely correct, right? We said we were going to let the government decide who owns property, and in this case, they've decided that the Rockefellers, the Kennedys, and the Bushes own all of those states, right? So they abolish all of the taxes, and they give all control over to the property owners to run their private property as they see fit. And this is where the utilitarians run into some problems. See, as we discussed earlier, the utilitarians don't have a system of justice in property. They simply accept whatever means lead to what they perceive as less government interference and more personal freedom. Because they have no foundation for how property rights are derived, they would just have to accept this decree of the former states of New York and Massachusetts and Texas, and just be willing to live in the fiefdom that's created by these powerful families. But the natural rights libertarians are in a much better position to reject this ownership of New York by the Rockefellers and so on, because only the natural rights libertarians have a consistent system of justice in property that doesn't rely on the state's arbitrary decrees. So bear with me as I explain to you what that system of justice is in physical property that the natural rights libertarians believe in. We have to start first with the realization that human beings cannot exist purely by themselves. And I mean this quite literally. We don't exist in some vacant, nebulous cloud, right? Physically, we have to stand on Earth. We have to transform raw materials into goods that are usable by ourselves or other human beings. And these raw materials can be in the form of food or lumber or clothing or tools or what have you. But in order to survive, it's plain to see that human beings must not only own themselves, as we've talked about, but they also have to own material objects so that they can then have control over them and use them to their benefit. And in a world of scarce resources, we have to figure out how we allocate this property in a manner that is consistent with individual rights, specifically respecting non-aggression as it relates to others. So let's take a look at another hypothetical situation that I'm going to modify slightly from the one that Rothbard used. I want you to imagine a brewer, the person who makes your favorite beer. The brewer takes all sorts of raw ingredients and concocts them in a certain manner in order to make your beverage of choice. So when the beer is ready, who owns it at that point? It's the brewer's creation, isn't it? I mean, he may not have created the raw goods, right? But nobody does that. I mean, you know, there are raw goods that are inherent on this earth that no man has created. They were created for us, right? But I would argue that the brewer has certainly created the final product that you want to obtain and consume. And I think very few people would argue that the brewer doesn't own the beer at this point. And so we have to think, well, why is that? Why is it so typical that common sense teaches us that, yes, of course the brewer owns the beer at this point? Well, the answer is because most people naturally understand that because the brewer owns himself, then he also owns his labor. And if he owns his labor, then he also owns whatever becomes the product of that labor mixed with raw goods. as long as those raw goods were not already owned by someone else. So the next obvious question becomes, well, how do we determine who owns the raw goods in the first place? And in order to understand that, we have to go through the theory of what's called homesteading. And simply put, homesteading is an understanding that whoever first takes a raw, unclaimed good or a piece of land and mixes his labor with it to develop it or collect it or improve it or build upon it, that person is the rightful owner of that good or that piece of land. Rothbard in the book uses another scenario. He asks you to imagine a person walking in the woods and comes upon an acorn that has fallen from the tree. And nobody's around. Nobody owns this land. It's back in the day when the earth was first made and the first man comes upon an acorn. Well, who owns the acorn, right? When it's on the ground, I guess nobody owns it. But the very fact that the person walks up to the acorn, bends down, and picks it up, doesn't that make it his? As long as no one else has a rightful claim to it, yes, it would be his, correct? So to understand how we as libertarians can justify the notion of homesteading, I think it's important to use this process of elimination just like we did previously when we were examining the theory of self-ownership. So let's look at the possible options that might answer the question of who rightfully owns physical property. And for this examination, I'm going to refer to consumer goods a few times. And I need you to understand that when I refer to consumer goods, I'm referring to those goods that were created when you combined your labor and skills with some raw goods that you found or acquired in order to create a new product that is possibly desired by someone else, or at least serves a specific purpose for you. The three options are, number one, someone else owns the consumer goods that you created. Number two would be each person on the planet owns an equal share of those consumer goods that you created. Or number three, you own the consumer goods that you've created. And I think already you're probably understanding, or at least you can see where I'm going with this because of our conversation about self-ownership, right? Just as we found when we examined the notion of self-ownership, it's preposterous to believe that someone else owns the product that you created. If that were true, no one would ever have any incentive to produce any goods, and we'd all be left to fend for ourselves without any improvements on the natural materials with which we've been blessed. Additionally, if we take even a cursory look at the idea that every person owns an equal share of the goods that you produce, we immediately find that, again, this is impossible to practice for the same reason that it was impossible to practice when we examined self-ownership. It's impractical in terms of the logistics. I mean, how is it possible that every single person on the planet could take ownership of one thing? No one would know what to do with it. Logistically speaking, nothing would ever get done, just like we talked about in terms of self-ownership. But again, if we tried to practice this communal ownership, what would ultimately happen, as history teaches us, is that some sort of oligarchy would take power or appoint itself as the ruling class, and they would claim to be the owner of all property. And of course, this would lead us right back to the first scenario where somebody else owns what you've created. And we've already shown that that's not feasible. So again, based on the same process of elimination, we have to conclude that the only plausible system of justice in property rights includes the idea that you own whatever consumer goods that you've created simply by joining your labor with raw materials. And the exact same conclusion would be reached if we were to examine the problem of who owns specific pieces of land, right? Whoever discovers an untamed and unclaimed piece of land and then takes the time to improve on it, well, they would be the rightful property owner. And that is truly what's called homesteading. Now, just so that you know, and so that I'm giving you full notice, there are some objections to the idea of homesteading. And unfortunately, I don't have enough time to go into them in this podcast, but I would highly recommend that you read about them in Rothbard's book, For a New Liberty. Once again, that'll be referenced at the show notes page. He tackles those common objections and, you know, in a fashion that you probably are accustomed to by now from Rothbard, a very thorough examination of those objections. So to sum up everything we've talked about, I want to quote Rothbard directly because he does just a really nice job of a summation. He says, quote, "The central core of the libertarian creed, then, is to establish the absolute right to private property of every man, first in his own body, and second in the previously unused natural resources, which he first transforms by his labor. These two axioms, the right of self-ownership and the right to homestead, establish the complete set of principles of the libertarian system. The entire libertarian doctrine then becomes the spinning out and the application of all of the implications of this central doctrine." End quote. So, as Rothbard said, we then simply begin to apply all of these ideas that we've talked about to their implications, or as I like to say it, you take all of these implications to their logical conclusions. And you've heard that before. When I talked about voluntarism in episodes 9 and 10, one of the things I asked you to do was to consistently apply your philosophy about the use of force and coercion, or to take your philosophy to its logical conclusion. And this is precisely what Rothbard is telling us to do now with our system of property rights. So, for example, one logical conclusion we can draw from the system of property rights that we've laid out here is the idea of what's called free exchange and free contract. A quick example, if I own some peppers that I grew in my garden and my neighbor owns some apples that she grew, there's a good chance that we might want to exchange some of those goods. And as long as the exchange is voluntary, then each of us is free to do so, and we would gain proper ownership of the goods that were previously owned by the other. I gain some apples, and she gains some peppers. Furthermore, you can exchange your labor itself. So maybe I don't have anything physical to trade, but I certainly can trade my labor to someone else in return for the same raw goods, or, hey, even maybe currency. And of course, that's precisely what happens whenever anybody gets a job. And so I hope that illustrates the final pieces of the puzzle as it relates to libertarian philosophy on property. And to close out the topic, I want to again quote directly from Rothbard, since he always puts it so eloquently. Quote, "It so happens that the free market economy and the specialization and division of labor that it implies is by far the most productive form of economy known to man, and has been responsible for industrialization and for the modern economy on which civilization has been built. This is a fortunate utilitarian result of the free market, but it is not, to the libertarian, the prime reason for his support of this system. That prime reason is moral and is rooted in the natural rights defense of private property we have developed above. Even if a society of despotism and systematic invasion of rights could be shown to be more productive than what Adam Smith called the system of natural liberty, the libertarian would support this system. Fortunately, as in so many other areas, the utilitarian and the moral, natural rights, and general prosperity go hand in hand." End quote. Well, I don't think I could put it any better than that, and I think that's a perfect bookend to end our discussion on property rights. Before I let you go for good for this episode, I do have just a couple of things to say. Number one, I'm very pleased to announce that October was a huge growth month for the Battle for Liberty podcast. I far exceeded the goal that I set for myself in terms of month-over-month growth, and I have only the listeners to thank for that. So thank you for taking the time to listen. Second thing, you know, I don't get paid for this podcast, and I rarely ask you to do much for me. But what I am going to ask you to do is to help me meet my next month-over-month growth goal. And in order to do that, I really need you to be subscribed on iTunes and Stitcher. And I also need you to spread the word about the show. You know, post on Twitter about the show, log into iTunes and give me a review, forward the emails that you get from me if you're subscribed to the email list. These are all things that you can do to help me in my endeavor to grow the show. So subscribe on iTunes, follow me on Twitter, join the email list, and if you do those things and you enjoy this and you're downloading, then I'll be right here doing it all for you week after week. So until next time, battle on.